where we eliminated county courts and went to one district court in 1987. State funding of the trial courts was completed in 2005, and the transition to a single statewide case management system, MINSIS, in 2008. The other thing that you'll see in your packet is a recent report just out this week from the National Center for State Courts. This re-engineering report was an effort by this national organization to look at model judicial systems around the country to see who is re-engineering their efforts in a way that would be something to show off to other courts across the jurisdictions. So one of the things that we want to highlight are some of the things that were in that report. I see you may not have that report.
We don't have that report.
I'm looking for Ms. Marshall, who has that report to hand out. So we'll get that to you, sorry. The re-engineering efforts that we're going to talk about today fall into three general categories: consolidation, centralization, and automation, where we have tried to leverage technology and our unified system to make the changes that we need to make. I'll talk a little bit about consolidation and then turn it over to our judges. One of the major initiatives at containing costs has been our efforts to examine the administrative functions of our courts and to consolidate responsibilities. This gives you some of those examples, one being sharing across district lines, our biggest focus being the 7th and 8th districts, which have been piloting sharing district administrators and other functions, but we are continuing to do that in other district courts. Consolidation of court administrator positions. We started off with 87 separate county court administrators and now have 24 of those who are operating in multi-jurisdictions. 13 court administrators oversee two counties, 9 oversee three counties, and 2 of them oversee 4 counties. So we've gone from 87 middle management court administrators now down to 48, or a 45% reduction in those ranks. In addition, we have tried to consolidate functions both within districts and across districts in areas like jury management, scheduling of interpreters, doing scheduling and assignment of child support magistrates, state funding, and a single administrative level of operations has really helped us to see across district and county lines to do consolidation wherever possible, and we continue to do more of that. I'm now going to turn over to Judge Jim Flory to talk a little bit about some of our other major initiatives.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and go ahead.
Thank you, Chairman Hillstrom. My name is Jim Flory, and I am a judge of district court. I'm chambered up in St. Louis County in Virginia. I've been a judge for about 14 years now. I've either been the assistant chief or chief judge of our district for 8 of those years, and I'm currently the vice chair of the State Judicial Council. And it's a privilege for me to appear for you before you here today to talk about some of the initiatives that have been undertaken by the state court system in the last few years. By far, our most ambitious initiative to date is centralizing our payable citations. Of the 1.5 million cases a year that the courts handle, about 1 million of them are payable citations, traffic citations, DNR ordinance violations. Centralization of the processing of these cases enables the judiciary to leverage technology as well as take advantage of economies of scale to reduce our labor costs and improve service to the public. We have re-engineered how we process these kinds of cases by moving them from the local courthouses in each of our 87 counties to a new centralized virtual payment center with fewer lower-paid staff working from their homes. Under the new centralized operation, cases are initiated more quickly, payment received and deposited on the same day it's received, and citizens receive the same service levels regardless of which part of the state their citation was issued in. The public benefits by having the option to dispose of a single or multiple citations from multiple counties 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, using telephone or the internet and by paying by credit card. Now, the transition from local court processing has been completed in 85 of our 87 counties and was completed in June of 11, and we expect to bring in Hennepin and Ramsey County, which already have their own centralized processes, in the next biennium. And to date, this program, the Court Payment Center, has received 2 national awards for its innovation. we've conducted a preliminary evaluation. Go ahead.
Okay. Representative Lesch. Okay. All right. Judge Flory, go ahead.
Thank you. We've conducted a preliminary evaluation of the results achieved, and some of those results include a reduction in the number of appearances in court for these minor cases from 2008 to 2011. The number of cases requiring an appearance has dropped from 30% of the cases to 13%. And in fact, in Virginia alone, where I'm chambered, we've been able to eliminate one morning calendar a week where we handled these types of matters and free up that court time for the other cases, the 82% of the cases where judges spend the majority of their time. And by doing so, we've also freed up time for our public defenders and other justice partners who participate in those proceedings. In addition, easier means of payment has increased our revenue collection. For fiscal year 11, over $50 million was receipted by the courts, and that's an increase of $2.8 million over fiscal year 10. And we've also teamed with the Minnesota Department of Revenue to more effectively collect overdue debt. We'll discuss this a little more in a few slides, but I just want to note here that for payable citations, overdue debt collected in fiscal year 11 was $4.8 million compared to less than $1 million in fiscal year 10. So by those measures, the program has been a significant success. The next initiative I want to highlight for you is our oversight of conservator accounts. I have to tell you that this is an area for judges that creates a great deal of heartburn. The courts of Minnesota are required by law to monitor conservator accounts and reports, and the courts currently are responsible for and provide oversight of more than $600 million in protected assets in 5,200 cases. Most Minnesota courts found it difficult to fulfill this responsibility, and that's where the heartburn comes in. There were no established statewide standards or requirements for financial reports. There were no statewide standardized accounting practices. Much of the court staff's time was spent reviewing and balancing reports rather than examining the substance of the reports. To help control this unmanageable paper system, Ramsey County developed the CAMPER system, which stands for the Conservator Account Monitoring Preparation and Electronic Reporting System. CAMPER provides online entry by conservators of account reports in a standardized format that assures accurate calculations, and the Judicial Council, seeing that CAMPER was effective at improving conservatorship oversight and reducing administrative costs, expanded the system statewide. Since January 1st of 2011, conservators appointed by the court have completed their annual reports to the court online. Now, together with that, the court has also launched this year a new statewide conservator account auditing program, which kind of takes up where the CAMPER program left off. And this program is supervised by the 10th District Judicial Administrator, and it includes a specialized auditing staff to improve oversight of this important area of court work. The CAP staff will implement consistent statewide review schedules, provide guidance on which accounts to review and how often, create red flags to help identify circumstances that are unusual in nature, and to signal that maybe something is out of the ordinary and needs further investigation. It trains court staff on how and when to review accounts and how and when to refer accounts to the CAP auditors for further scrutiny, and it audits all accounts in excess of $3,000 and others as identified by local courts. And I think this goes a long way in protecting the citizens who are subject to these conservator accounts and to make sure that their funds are not being misappropriated. The next program I want to highlight, or initiative, is the consolidation of our jury management functions. Prior to 2009, Minnesota jury management system was loaded on 89 different databases, and juror information on each database was maintained by jury staff at each court location. Under this consolidated program, we now use automated technology for summoning and qualifying Minnesota citizens for jury service. And as part of the program, we've centralized and outsourced our juror summons and questionnaire process. We've developed an online juror questionnaire. We've eliminated prepaid postage on return juror questionnaires, and we've centralized, automated, and outsourced our juror postcard notices. The goals of the project were to reduce our jury operating costs, increase staff efficiency, and improve service to our citizens who perform jury service. And we've met those goals. For example, in our centralizing and outsourcing the juror summons and postcard notices, and by eliminating the prepaid postage for returned questionnaires, this produced alone a savings of $103,500 in just the annual postage costs statewide. Our court staff in 89 locations no longer to need to generate, print, fold, stuff, seal, apply postage, and mail these summons and notices to jurors. And this is an annual staff saving time of about four positions. And, you know, for instance, in Virginia, where I have some familiarity, our juror summonsing and that all of that's taken care of over in Bemidji, which is in a different judicial district. So we've been able to consolidate those in into that location.
If I might interrupt.
Go ahead.
So, Judge Flory, have you had less participation in the jury questionnaire since you've eliminated the return postage on the jury questionnaire? Judge Flory.
Chairman Hillstrom, we haven't totally eliminated it because there still is the option for that, but we haven't had it's optional, I guess, is my point, and I'll get to that here. I think our numbers indicate that about 26% since we've initiated the program in just the last year or so, we've got about a 26% response to our online questionnaire. And the rest, you know, they can still respond by paper. But last year, 45,000 potential jurors responded to us online, which was 26% of the total.
So, Judge Flory, so is that a reduced amount, or is that number increased now that you're going more online?
The online reporting is increasing every year, and we're not noticing that I'm aware of any decline in the number of jurors responding in total.
Thank you. Judge Flory.
Thank you.
Representative Druskowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Judge Flory, I'm back a couple of slides here, but on slide 25 you were talking about the centralized payable citations, and it mentions fewer lower paid staff working from home. I'm kind of curious a little more how that system works. Online bill pay and associated technology is very ubiquitous nowadays. It would seem to me that the person holding the citation and their account number could simply enter their credit card number, pay the fine, and all tracking could be done electronically and reported back. Curious what the need for staff is in that situation.
Judge Flory.
Chairman Hillstrom and Representative Gruskowski, there's still a need for staff. There's oftentimes questions that people have about that, and when they get a citation, even though they have it, you can make it as clear as possible, but they still have the need for a call center to answer any questions. Online bill pay is just one way that we do it. The other way is telephone. There's a telephone system where they can do it over the phone also. There still is a need for a reduced staff. I don't know, Jeff, if you have any other information about what the staff provide also.
Madam Chair, Representative Druskowski, the main work that staff are doing from home is two things. One is they are processing the citations. We get them scanned in and they can then pull them up and process the fact that people have paid them online. The second thing, and it's a pretty small staff, less than 10 people, who are working from home and answering questions, as Judge Flory said. The reason that we have those people answering the questions and we monitor closely their workload and demand and monitor their conversations just like any call center would is because if we don't have those people doing that, they're probably going to show up in court and take more court time. So we have a few people who are doing the telephone work at home. That's all they do is answer questions and try to help people navigate. So if your point is, could we mandate that all of them have to pay it online? We probably would have a lot more people come to court and take judge time then, so that's why we've tried to keep some people answering questions.
Representative Paymer.
Madam Chair, as long as we're back at that slide, I'm just curious if you're planning on coming to the legislature to increase the offenses that will now that will be payables in the future, or is that not on the table anymore?
Mr. Sherpa.
Madam Chair, Representative Paymar, it's not on the table right now for this session. We have already, with our own authority, made some of these payable. Every year we look at the offenses that we have the jurisdiction to make payable offenses, and just in December we outlined the ones that we've considered at the council level to do that. But I don't think during this session we have any initiative to come and try to change those more significantly, unless there's some interest in the legislature to do that.
Madam Chair,
Representative Paymer.
If I understood that, Mr. Sherba, so you can unilaterally do that? You don't need legislative approval to...
Mr. Sherba.
We can. There are certain ones that we certainly need legislative approval for, but we're mandated every year to approve a payables list at the Judicial Council level. Unfortunately, that task has been mine to chair the committee that does that for about the last 4 years. It's not a particularly popular program, but to go through that. But every year, you know, we have to publish a payables list that applies statewide and have authority to do that over certain offenses.
Representative Chair, could the committee get a copy of that list? I'd like to see it.
Yes, Representative Paymer will get a copy.
There's actually three lists. I assume there's the traffic, there's a DNR payables list, and there's a trucks and common carriers payable list. And so,
the what?
Representative Paymer.
No, that was all. Thank you.
Representative Druskowski, then Lesch, then Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Gentlemen, I'm trying to understand better. It's been a couple of years since I've been on this committee, but. With the payables, remind me, don't they have the ability to either go through the court system or pay the fine? And if so, wouldn't the incentive to not, or the deterrence, if you will, of I don't know exactly how to explain here. You've got a choice at that point. Either you're going to go through the court system, which is probably as a person who has been cited, something that is not a desirable approach, or you can pay the fine. And obviously, if you are challenging the charges, you're probably going to go through the court system anyway. You've got a choice at that point. There's a Y in the road. It would seem to me I'm having trouble understanding the administrative needs that you outlined around these part-time individuals.
Is there a question there, Representative Druskowski, or just a statement?
I guess it's just a statement, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you, Representative Lesch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Judge Flory, can you help me out? If I commit a crime on the payables list and have to pay, say, $200 or $150, on my next job application, do I have to check that I've been convicted of a crime?
Judge Flory.
Madam Chair and Representative Lesch, no, anything that is payable that comes through the system, you're talking about the issue of collateral consequences. The vast majority of them are non-criminal, petty misdemeanor offenses. So I don't know that any of those would require the checking of that box. And I don't know if anybody can correct me on that.
Judge Cahill.
Well, first of all, good afternoon, members of the committee. My name is Pete Cahill, and I am the Chief Judge of the 4th District, which is Hennepin County. And generally, if there's some of the things on the payable list, it may be a statutory misdemeanor, but there is no payment above the petty misdemeanor level, because if they were to pay an amount that would make it a conviction, a criminal conviction, a misdemeanor, we would require all the rights waivers that are normally a part of a guilty plea in court. So any payment through the payment center is going to result in a petty misdemeanor, a non-criminal conviction.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Right.
My next question is then, last time I looked at that payables list, Representative Paymar, was a couple years ago, and it had bear baiting on it. And bear baiting was the only old vestige of old gross misdemeanors that we used to have, and all of a sudden we started making more gross misdemeanors, which of course don't have fiscal notes. in this committee or your committee, but which nonetheless have impact on local government. But bear baiting on the list, which is punishable by no more than a year in jail or a $3,000 fine. How is it then, either Judge Cahill or Judge Flory, that when this body, this legislature, states that a person is convicted of a crime that is punishable by up to a year in jail, you can decide as a matter of policy that it's not a crime?
Judge Flory.
Madam Chairman and Representative Blatchett, I'll have to confess my ignorance. I didn't know bear baiting was on there, but if it would be a statutory gross misdemeanor, we wouldn't have the authority without the consent of this body to deem it a payable offense. So I guess I can't address that one, question for, specifically.
Okay, Madam Chair.
Representative Blatchett.
If I could, Judge, I don't think that's correct, and if it is, if you are correct, I'd like to see a citation on that, because there are very few gross misdemeanors on that list. There are a lot more misdemeanors, but let's dispense with the gross misdemeanor example, and let's use a misdemeanor example, punishable by no more than 90 days in jail or a $1,000 fine. What implications does it have for a separation of powers, whereby this body has decided that something is punishable by jail time, and then the courts, as a matter of forward-looking policy, saying, no, nothing of this sort, of this crime, is now criminal. You've effectively decriminalized something that this legislative body has decided is criminal. What implications does that have for separation of powers?
Who wants that one? Judge Flory?
Well, I'll take a shot at it, Madam Chairman and Representative Lash, and then I'll turn it over to my colleagues here. Also, in making the matters payable, we only set the fine amount, and if the citizen chooses to pay that amount, then that takes care of it, and there's no court appearance. They can choose not to pay the amount on misdemeanor level offenses and come to court, and then the matter, there is no separation of powers issue. The matter is handled as any misdemeanor matter would that comes before the court.
Okay.
So it's not a mandatory process.
Representative Lesh, I am certain we're going to debate this issue a bit this session, but
let me just add a final caveat, and thank you, Madam Chair, for your indulgence, but as members can tell, this has been an issue for me of the past 2 years, and I think members in this body have generally not made it an issue, including myself, because the courts have gotten beat up on so much for funding, and you're trying to make lemonade out of lemons, and we understand that. But that said, this absolutely has to be looked at in the future. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Lush. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question is much more simple. It has to do with the staff savings or the time savings, you said, on the centralized oversight of these conservator accounts. So back to slide 27, 28. And you said it was the equivalent of four FTEs and time savings, and I just wondered if you just reallocated what those staff members did or if there were four fewer staff members as a result of that change.
Judge Porter.
Madam Chair and Representative Scott, I think the four staff positions saved were in the jury management program, and if I misstated that, I apologize, but I think the staff positions were saved in folks at our local courthouses who no longer have to do the manual printing, folding, stuffing envelopes of the jury questionnaires. That's where those four staff savings came in that program.
Representative Scott.
Thank you. And so my question then is if they were they hired specifically, you said it's the equivalent of saving, four staff people, but those four staff people are still employed. They're just doing different things?
Well, it's four statewide, so it's a portion of a person at each courthouse.
Okay.
And no, they're probably not there anymore. If you walk around the Virginia Clerk of Courts office, as I have for the last 14 years, there's about four empty desks where we used to have bodies sitting. And those folks aren't there anymore because of consolidation and other initiatives that eliminated the need for those jobs, you know, through attrition.
Thank you.
Judge Flory, do you want to continue?
Thank you. The next initiative I'll mention is ITV. Another component of our innovations and our agenda in that regard relates to interactive television, or ITV, which is video conferencing technology. Last year, the Supreme Court amended the rules of criminal procedure to allow for the expanded use of ITV in criminal cases, which in turn will result in time and cost savings for our justice partners. One example could be, and we made this presentation about an hour ago in the Senate, or 2 hours ago in the Senate, and we gave this example, and it's a hypothetical. The senator asked me, did this really happen to you? And I had to say no, because it hasn't happened to me yet. But the example could be, with the change in the rules, was that, for instance, an offense convicted or committed in Virginia, where I sit, if a person commits an offense there and is picked up on a warrant for that offense, for instance, in another county out of the district, Blue Earth County or some other county, in the past, the St. Louis County Sheriff's Office would have had to have sent an officer to Mankato to pick up that person and return them to the originating jurisdiction for a bail hearing, which might only take a few minutes. Now that defendant could appear under the rule changes and make that initial appearance in Blue Earth County via ITV, which will eliminate those transportation costs and the time involved in a six-hour round trip. And the law enforcement officer who would have escorted the defendant can better spend that time protecting public safety in the community. ITV is being expanded, and it's being used in a variety of ways throughout our judicial districts. The 9th District in northwestern Minnesota and in southwestern Minnesota, the 5th District has used ITV extensively. Because many of those counties don't have chambered judges, but they do have jails and law enforcement authority. So someone might get arrested there and there's no judge there, and there might not be a judge scheduled there for a long time or a number of days. And so without having someone travel one way or the other, ITV is being utilized to avoid the expense of travel and to avoid a person having to wait for a judge to get there. So the expanded use of ITV has been very beneficial to the courts.
Judge Flory,
yes.
Is just ITV's the majority of the use in greater Minnesota, or have you seen a large implementation of ITV in the metropolitan area as well? Judge Flory.
Chairman Hillstrom, I think perhaps Judge Cahill might be better to answer that question since he's the chief of the fourth, but I think it's occurring equally in the metro also.
Judge Cahill.
Madam Chair, we actually use ITV quite a bit, for example, in the mental health commitment area, because people may be committed out of Hennepin County, but they may have their placement or treatment far away. And the reviews that are a part of the mental health commitment process is very disruptive to take somebody out of their hospital setting, have a couple of sheriff's deputies show up, bring them down to Hennepin, and then drag them back after a short court appearance. So we've been able to use ITV with some of the treatment centers in order to do a review on somebody's mental health commitment status, keeping them in their treatment environment, which is obviously in the better interest of the patient anyway. We've also been able to use ITV for people who are in our workhouse. So if they are serving a sentence, but they have a number of unpaid tickets or other minor matters that they need to resolve, our hearing officers are able to interact with them by ITV. So we don't have to transport them downtown from the workhouse while they're in custody. Instead, work over ITV to resolve some of their minor traffic matters that are still lingering after their other cases may have been resolved.
Just a follow-up to that, Judge Cahill. So are you also using that to clear up minor citations for folks that are in prison? And is it on a judicial district by judicial district basis they get to decide whether to implement it or not? Or how is that working, Judge Cahill?
Madam Chair, I'm not aware of anybody who's done that yet. We have a pilot that's been proposed. Stearns County was going to start, since they have prisons right there handy, to do a ITV pilot to take care of a lot of the minor misdemeanor and petty misdemeanor matters that people in state prison have. That obviously involves dealing with the Department of Corrections and having them work with us to set up an ITV station within the prison. But we have a pilot that's ongoing that Judge Mabley from our district is going to work with the DOC to be a part of that pilot to try and work ITV to the prisons, just like we do with our workhouse.
And then each judicial district, do they decide on their own, or Judge Cahill?
Madam Chair, it probably will be each district, but it's more the facilities they have. I think if everyone looks at, if the system works well and it's more efficient and we are not wasting sheriff's time transporting people back and forth and the inherent security danger that always comes with transporting people in custody, I think everybody will jump on board. Right now, we don't have a process set out, and this pilot will shake out the bugs of the process, the technology, and working with DOC to make sure how we move people within the DOC to get to the right spot to be able to do that. And there's a lot of little detailed questions that we're going to have to answer first, but then it'll be up to the districts to adopt. Most have ITV technology, so I would not be surprised that they adopt it after we can shake out the bugs.
Thank you. Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Judge Cahill, as you know, technology is moving faster than we are, and I'm kind of curious to what extent are we hanging on kind of the legacy ITV technology, which is rather unwieldy, and to what extent are we looking forward to the more nimble future in electronics, looking at Skype and some of those technologies that can also be secured reasonably and also be much more deployable and cut down on costs additionally. Be interested in any comments you might have.
Judge Cahill.
Madam Chair, Representative Drazkowski, we actually, our ITV we have is very sophisticated now. It's not the early type teleconferencing that used to occur. This is actually over fiber optic networks with very high quality ITV stations. So it's much better than Skype as far as quality, so that we can ensure that everyone is on the same page. I have a reputation, and I'll be talking about eCourt Minnesota in a little bit, of hating paper. And so I'm very much with the idea of moving forward with all the technology that we're seeing in the private sector and moving forward into an entirely electronic court environment. Any technology that will improve what we got, I've always gotten, I spend my nights reading the tech rags more than I do law. So I'm with you on that, and we're always looking for ways to improve what we have. In fact, I'll talk a little bit later on about the use of ITV for interpreter services, which is not just a simple interactive television system.
Please continue.
Thank you. I just want to highlight two other court initiatives and then turn the matter over to Judge Cahill. One deals with our centralized bail bond program. Prior to 2005, each judicial district managed the approval of bail bond agents locally. Since then, the processing of all bail bond applications, suspensions, and renewals is conducted through the Minnesota State Court Administrator's office. And the purpose of centralizing the bail bond process was to simplify and standardize the approval process statewide. For practical purposes, this means that applicants no longer have to apply for bonding privileges in each judicial district in the state in which they wish to issue bail bonds. As of July 2012, there are 470 approved bonding agents, 44 active bonding agencies, and 33 active surety companies. Along with this, the State Court Administrator's Office procedures include standards of conduct for bonding agencies and agents, and these procedures also include a complaint and investigation process for complaints alleging the violation of the standards of conduct. The final initiative I want to talk to you about is drug courts or problem-solving courts. This service delivery redesign is one that we're very proud of, and we have a number of drug and problem-solving courts around the state. Today, there's 37 of them active at this time. Drug and other problem-solving courts, which are really just specialized trial court calendars, use the coercive power of the court in collaboration with other justice partners to closely monitor the defendant's progress towards sobriety and recovery through frequent drug testing, ongoing treatment, regular court check-ins, and the use of immediate sanctions and incentives to help the offender to a sober and law-abiding life. They invest more time and resources up front for a better long-term outcome on the back end. Mental health courts are also starting to come to the forefront, and they are special courts that focus on people who have been charged with a crime and have a psychiatric disability. the purpose of the court is to deal with the crime in a way that addresses the person's mental health needs, which is often the reason why they're before the court in the first place. The mental disability is the focus rather than the criminal behavior, and treatment, medical care and supervision, case management, and service referral are the primary components of the mental health courts. In addition, the 4th Judicial District in Hennepin County have implemented a Veterans Court in 2010 with its mission to promote public safety and assist and support veterans and their families by creating a coordinated response through collaboration with the Veterans Service Delivery System, community-based services, and the criminal justice system. The target population consists of defendants who have served in the United States Armed Forces, who are experiencing treatable behavioral and chemical health issues such as PTSD, anger management or domestic violence issues, and or chemical dependency types issues. And there should be a brochure in your materials about the Hennepin County Veterans Court.
I don't think we have it.
It wouldn't print until, so I assume we'll get that to you.
Thank you.
You're welcome. The State Court Administrator's Office recently completed a 2.5-year study of 500 adult drug court participants, and the study compared these participants with almost 650 comparison participants. And the study showed reduced recidivism and increased in community engagement by the drug court graduates. Regarding recidivism, new charges and convictions are lower for drug court participants. From drug court entry through 2.5 years after, and drug court lasts approximately 1.5 years, about 25%, 26% of drug court participants had new charges, compared with 41% of the comparison group. Conviction rates were also lower for the drug court participants at 17% versus 32%. One drug court goal is to ensure that the participants are accountable for their decisions and improve the quality of their life, the life of their families, and their communities. And over 1/2 of the participants, or 54%, who start drug court, they graduate. Almost all participants receive treatment, and 80% complete at least one treatment session. And in addition, non-metro participants are more likely to gain a valid driver's license. We've also found that over the 2.5 years that drug court participants spend about half as much time in prison as the comparison and 2/3 as much time incarcerated overall, and that drug court participants in almost all the courts spend less time in jail over the 2.5 years than the comparison group, which considering the lessened recidivism results in significant savings in terms of the costs of their incarceration. So with that, I'll turn the matter over to Judge unless there's a question.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Chairwoman. I just have a question. I know this is fairly new. How many graduates do you have from drug court?
Statewide?
Mm-hmm.
Judge Flory.
Oh, I don't know. Can you give us that number, Jim?
Can you get us that number?
Well,
you have to come to the table, state your name.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to invite someone new, but I tried to get an answer to your question here, the exact number.
Sure. My name is Katie Scher, research analyst with the State Court Administrator's Office, and I was working on the drug court evaluation. It's 54% of those that were participants in the evaluation graduated. So you could say of the, I think it's around 550, half of those graduated. That was in a period of 2.5 years. So we do annually collect information and do tabulations that go back to about 2007. So we can get back to you with that information about exactly how many have graduated.
Thank you.
Judge Flory.
If there are no other questions, I'll turn the matter over. Is there?
Representative Duskowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick question. I'm just, Judge Flory, just curious. And I've seen some success around drug courts in southeast Minnesota. But one of the things, of course, that you have is you've got the different factions in the bureaucracy looking at their pot of money. I'm curious what type of success you've had in funding these internally with existing budgets, or have you just been growing another section of government? Kind of curious.
I hope we're not, Madam Chair and Representative Kraskowski. Most of the drug courts have started with the assistance of state funds and federal grant monies. And I think I've seen a slide somewhere that maybe 20 of them now receive some of those funds. The others are self-funded. There's many ways to calculate the savings of these drug courts. Dollars and cents is one way of doing it. But the one way, at least in my experience in our drug court on the range, is that the local authorities took over the responsibility for funding it, meaning the corrections and the law enforcement in those areas, because they saw the benefits of the reduced recidivism and the reduced jail days, which most of those are county dollars. And so they have staffed the drug courts. The courts still participate in those, and we provide the coordinator of it, but the rest of the probation officers, the treatment folks that are participating in it, gain through whatever dollars they get through providing treatment. So I don't think we're creating a different group of government employees through this. It's the same people, but the local authorities in many jurisdictions are taking over the funding of the program.
Representative Griscoe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Judge Flory. It sounds like the walls are starting to come down then a little bit from what I understood a few years ago. Thank you.
I think that's very true.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chairwoman. I just have a follow-up question. So how many people in our jail system are dealing with either mental health issues or addiction issues?
Judge Flory? If you don't have that information, do you think you could get us that information?
Well, I can't give you the exact number. We can certainly do that. I mean, anecdotally, I can tell you that it's probably better than 90% of the people that appear for me in front of me on arraignment calendars charged with criminal offenses or juvenile calendars have some component of a chemical or mental health problem.
Madam Chair, Representative O'Neill, I'm sure that since I used to work for Corrections could give us those statistics of people who are on some kind of medication or other kinds of things, but I remember it being a very high number. So we could talk to them and find out,
we'll ask them. Further questions? Judge Cahill.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Just so you know, we have about 30 minutes left of committee.
Well, court reporters hate the fact that I can talk 300 words a minute, so I'll try and do my 300 words a minute. One of the challenges that we are dealing with statewide as a court is the fact that more and more of our litigants are self-represented due to economic, probably more than anything else. I don't think people want to go to court on their own and represent themselves. It's just a necessity at times. Maybe some do because they watch too much TV, but I think most realize that it's a tough thing, and they go in and they become confused and frustrated. And because they are not experts in the law, it tends to make the hearings go slower and requires judges to spend more time untangling what are sometimes incomprehensible filings with the court. For years in Hennepin County, we have had a self-help center to kind of address that for people who can't afford a lawyer but need just some basic guidance on the forms that are out there, and have people review those forms after they're filled out just to see if they're complete, not to give legal advice, but just on, okay, you've got all the paperwork you need to go forward with the judge, to avoid them filing paperwork that's incomplete that a judge just has to send them back to start over, causing greater frustration. The self-help center, which was strictly a brick-and-mortar operation in its inception, now has moved beyond to both a website and a phone self-help center. We have attorneys who work for kind of shared between state court and the 4th Judicial District who man the phones and receive calls from statewide for people who have called the statewide self-help number. They're actually talking to somebody most often in Hennepin County to guide them through what they would guide them through if they came in person to our counters. We also have a website that you can see here on the slide with a variety of different forms and guides that can help people as they try and work their way through the justice system. To give you an idea of volume, in 2011, the website homepage was accessed 693,000 times. And that was an increase of 18% over the prior year. And I don't have the 2012 numbers, but I can guarantee you it's even higher than that. Mm-hmm. We have seen the use of the website exploding because of the availability of the forum, so we are continually trying to improve the quality and the accessibility of that website. In addition, we have, as I said, we have the statewide self-help phone number, and in 2011, the three staff attorneys that are in the statewide self-help center assisted 17,769 callers, so roughly 6,000 people a year each, trying to guide them through the system. That's an increase of 20% over the prior year, and again, we're only seeing increases, not decreases. To give you an idea of the scope, our presiding judge in family court estimates that 60% of the persons appearing in family court are self-represented. So that's a lot of people trying to work their way through what is a very complex system with a lot of important issues at stake. I'll now descend into the more geeky part of my job, which is worrying about the tech stuff. Within the criminal justice system, obviously we have to keep track of information, and as Mr. Shorba noted, we implemented a statewide web-based case information system. What that has allowed us to do is to act as the foundation for data exchanges. These are exchanges of information that occur automatically in the background. For example, notifying a public defender of when a court date was set, or the jail notifying the court something about the custody status. Those integrations have to be built, but the ones that have been built have resulted in 50,000 data exchanges per day between our case management system. And when you think about that, that's information that somebody used to have to give over the phone or in an email or in a letter or writing. So we've been able to automate a lot of that to take the data entry, routine data entry, and routine tasks and automate them. We've also been able to centralize collections by having the statewide web-based system, and now we have an automatic referral to collections after 30 days delinquency on the fine or the payment plan. Because if someone receives a fine, they can go on a payment plan or pay it immediately. But when they breach that and are in default, essentially 30 days from then, we refer it to collections. Our the Department of Revenue now serves as a single collections agency, and this does provide significant time savings to the court and ensures the accuracy and timeliness of the referrals by having it automated and having it automated to the Department of Revenue.
Judge Cahill, I'm going to interrupt you for just a moment. It's my understanding that if there is a stay of adjudication that is not a conviction, and therefore you cannot send restitution requests to collections and things of that nature, is that correct? Judge
Madam Chair, that is correct. It does require a conviction, I think, by statute to give us that authority. So on a stay of adjudication where a judge has received a plea but has not adjudicated the person guilty, not convicted them, it's not technically a fine. It's usually costs. It does not go to collections as far as I know.
And so, for example, restitution then also cannot be collected in that fashion as well. Is that correct, Judge Cahill?
Madam Chair, I am drawing a blank. Yes. That is correct. We cannot use it to collect restitution. Most restitution, Madam Chair, however, is not collected by the courts. It's collected by either probation as a condition of their probation. In Hennepin County, that's been turned over actually to the county attorney's office, collects restitution on behalf of both the cities of Hennepin County and the county attorney prosecutions. And they have their own collection mechanism and entering orders for judgment and that type of thing.
But if there's a stay of adjudication, there's not a conviction, and therefore they can't use that for collections of restitution. Is that correct?
I believe you are correct with that formal process. They cannot. If it is a condition of the stay of adjudication, the court can bring a person back and possibly revoke the stay of adjudication for failure to pay. But I don't believe the formal process set up in the statute allows us to do it. You are correct.
All right. Judge Cahill.
Okay. To give you an idea of the actual numbers, you note the 200% increase. Total collection revenue increased from $6.37 million in fiscal year 2009 to $20.23 million in fiscal year 2012. So the process of centralizing it with Department of Revenue has greatly increased what we've collected. And what you see here is a picture of one of our court reporters in Hennepin County in the court monitoring room. This is a system set up where we remotely monitor what is going on in the courtroom and have an audio recording of what is occurring instead of a single court reporter going to the courtroom with a stenographic machine and taking it down in the traditional way. This allows us, as you can see, there are four courtrooms being monitored. If you look on the video screen to the right by this court reporter, he's monitoring four different courtrooms, using the software to tag the various events that are going on in the courtroom. For example, witness John Smith called and sworn, so that we can find that if we need to go back to the record. And he is able to monitor four different courtrooms, which means we have less of a need for court reporters than in the past. I mentioned earlier in Judge Flory's presentation about the use of interactive television, ITV, in Hennepin County. One of the ways we use it, this is Sebastian Mesa in this picture. He is now a hearing officer, but he was a court interpreter employed by the 4th District. And he is using the interactive TV to do interpreting in another district. One of the costs we have with interpreters is not only the time they're at the hearing, which sometimes can be 5 minutes, it's also the travel time, which can be in more distant locations, 3 hours there, 3 hours back. So we're paying interpreters a lot for traveling. This allows us, if we have the resources available near an ITV station, to use the system, which actually has been configured so that the interpreter can cut out different channels so that either plays to the courtroom so everyone can hear. In other words, when the Spanish speaker for Mr. Mesa over the loudspeaker in the courtroom can be heard interpreting in English, but he can also cut that out and have private conversations with the defendant and to include the defendant's attorney so that they can have a private attorney-client conversation, which only the parties that should hear can hear. So it's taken Skype to on steroids, really. But it's been configured and worked very well. I remember the first time Mr. Mesa tried it, he did a 5-minute hearing in Carver County, sitting in his office in Hennepin County, saved all the windshield time, and was able to do it without any extra cost to the judicial branch.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Chairwoman. And I may have missed this, but how many of our courts have the television system back and forth? I'm from Wright County. I know that they built a brand new building and they use it there. How many of our courts have that?
Judge Cahill.
Madam Chair, Representative O'Neill, I believe all of them have the facilities and capabilities. Many of us have, we don't have one in every courtroom. We have these mobile carts that we can move around, but most of the courtrooms are wired to accept this. In fact, for the remote interpreting, there were 700 incidents of remote interpreting last year, or fiscal year 12. So. And then,
Judge,
to give you an idea of the scope of what our interpreters, or the resources we have to access, these are the 15 most common interpreted languages, some of which probably are surprising that these are common languages that we have to find interpreters for. So you can imagine when we get languages that are not so common, it makes a lot more sense if we can do remote interpreting and not require somebody if there's only one. In fact, there's only one certified Somali interpreter in the entire country, and luckily he lives here. He travels everywhere. The feds always grab him from us, but he is the only certified Somali interpreter. In Hennepin County, the four most common are Spanish, Somali, Hmong, and Russian. No area of the law is in greater need of innovation, as all of you know, than family court because of the high costs, the delay in the acrimony that often accompanies divorce cases, and because we are often dealing with custody issues, and everyone is focused on the best needs of the children. The judicial branch embarked on a statewide effort to implement an alternative approach to litigation, a more collaborative model using ECM, which is early case management, and ENE, which is early neutral evaluation. And in this program, there's an initial case management conference where the parties appear before the judge within 3 weeks of filing. So as soon as you start your divorce action, within 3 weeks you're in front of a judge, and after filing, I think it's 60 to 75% of the cases settle at that first conference. So instead of protracted, dragged out litigation that just causes more acrimony, we're able to resolve a lot of those by having early judicial case management of those cases that are filed. The E&E is where a neutral comes in to evaluate, and that's both a social and a financial evaluation. And so for social, for custody, those type of things, but also financial on dividing up assets. And the neutrals then prepare a report. And again, a number of cases settled during these conferences. The E&E is voluntary, it's confidential, and it is an alternative dispute resolution to the normal litigation process. And the focus there is to generate durable settlements so that we don't have people coming back and back and back to court. The E&Es, to give you an idea, are usually within 3 weeks also of the initial case management conference. So filing, 3 weeks to the initial case management conference. 3 weeks later, they have the early neutral evaluation conference, so 6 weeks from filing. And a great many settle during that time. And those conferences usually take about 3 hours. Contrast that to the traditional alternative of a custody evaluation that usually takes 40-plus hours, costs several thousand dollars, and it takes months before it can be done. So there's a great deal of delay structurally built in when you use the traditional custody study method. E&E and ECM are being used everywhere in the state now, all the judicial districts, and some of our judges are even training nationwide. And finally, probably our most comprehensive project is eCourt Minnesota, and I'm co-chair of the steering committee along with Judge Lisa Borgen from Moorhead. And the vision of eCourt Minnesota is that the Minnesota courts will operate in an electronic information environment, and it will ensure the convenient, timely, and appropriate access to court information. We hope that all cases will be e-filed or submitted on paper and converted to electronic images. I prefer the former. I like it when we never have the paper and people just submit the electronic documents. But we have to remember how many self-represented litigants we have. And requiring them to do everything electronic is a bit of a burden right now. We are building tools that even self-represented litigants will be able to use this e-filing process, but we're not there yet. So we will be taking pictures of pieces of paper for a while. The important focus there is we have to be in an entirely electronic environment as a court. It's tough for everyone, judges and staff, to deal in two worlds. Okay, there's a paper part of the file and an electronic part of the file. So the paper we are receiving, we are imaging so that we have an entirely electronic file. And by attaching it to our case-wide system, it's available to judges wherever they are, and also to staff simultaneously. But we understand that when everybody's putting documents into our electronic bucket, that our partners in the justice system also need access. And so we are working currently on secure access to those electronic records. And Judge Flory mentioned what gives him heartburn, what gives me heartburn, the classification of documents. And this is where we are taking our time and being very deliberate, because as you can imagine, we don't want to publish out onto a website information like social security numbers, driver's license numbers, things that would aid identity theft. And so what gives me heartburn is making sure we don't ever do that. So the system we're building, we have a number of checks and balances built in, so hopefully that'll never happen.
So Judge Cahill, are you also working on how to make certain that everyone in the courtroom has access to those electronic documents? Public defender's offices, for example, pro se defendants, prosecutors, so that there'd be technology to make certain that everyone who needs access to that information would have it?
Yeah, Madam Chair, in addition to just the general access that the public should have to some of the court files, the participants in a case, we're working on some pilot projects where based on their login to our system, they can see all the documents, both public and confidential, in the case. For example, if a public defender is on a certain case, by signing in, they have access to all their cases and all the court documents. Because as an attorney on the case, they have the right to see the confidential documents and not just the public documents. We also have a system in Dakota County called First Appearance. It's an acronym, but basically, when a public defender shows up and he's got 90 new clients and he wants to access the court record, they get a password that's good for that day only. It allows them to access the court record for all the cases that are on that calendar so that they can see everything in the court file. So we are working on partner access is very important, because if the electronic system doesn't work for them, it's just going to slow the system down. It may be good for us because we have access, but we recognize that our partners, the attorneys, public defenders, prosecutors, city attorneys, have to have access as well. And we are working on it. Right now it's in the pilot phase.
Judge Cahill.
And the reasons, obviously, are that the public expects e-commerce methods, but more importantly, as you said, we have the foundation. We have the web-based case management system, so the technology is there to do it. What's the change is the court processing, and we need to change our business practices to make us more quick and efficient. So where are we on this massive rollout? And I like to say this is not a technology project. It's more a business process reengineering, because the technology is there. We just have to reengineer our business process to streamline what we're doing. We started in Hennepin and Ramsey in the fall of 2010 on a voluntary basis. Hennepin and Ramsey, now for lawyers, it is now mandatory for civil and family cases. Soon it will be mandatory for all lines of business. We added 9 additional counties to that, Cass, Clay, and Morrison, Washington, Dakota, Faribault, Shore, and if you look, at those counties touch every border of the state. The only one that's not up in the pilot yet is Kandy, Ohio. And they will, when they start in March, they will start in all lines of business. And so by the end of March, we hope to have all of those counties using electronic court environment for all lines of business. We're going to take a deep breath after that, figure out what needs to be changed or tweaked to make it work for the entire state, and then we will move through parts 2 and 3, adding counties, we hope, in a 4-year span, but we're going to see how the pilot goes first. The other important pilot that I'd like to talk about, Judge Flory mentioned how over 1 million of our cases are the minor cases. For example, the citation cases, the parking cases, the speeding tickets. And even though they are minor cases and don't take a lot of judge time, as you can imagine, something has to be entered for each one of those speeding tickets. Defendant name, address, that type of thing. There's a lot of routine data entry. So if you have all that electronic, that would help on our administrative side. And so currently, we've implemented e-citations where police officers can use electronic ticket writers and transmit the data to the court electronically, never producing paper for the court. Can save us a lot of routine data entry, so that when the centralized payment center has to deal with the people, they've got the information without having to re-enter the data. We're not completely there yet. As you can see, it's 58% right now, so we still have people entering the data from paper tickets. E-complaints, 51%, about half of our complaints that are charged in criminal cases are currently done entirely electronic. That is a separate system from our e-filing, because it's managed by the BCA for a very good reason. I'm sure those of you who've been on this committee have heard the word suspense file enough that you know that there's always a problem when we don't have fingerprints to attach to a conviction. And so we can't put that conviction on a person's criminal history because we don't have that match to the right person necessarily. E-complaints does that process of a prosecutor charges the case, but through the BCA system, it matches to the right person through fingerprints, so that when we charge a case, when the prosecutors charge the case, through the e-complaint system, we don't get that suspense issue because it's matching the people with the charge through the fingerprints. And it's too complicated for me to explain, to be honest with you. And with that, with the chair's permission, I'd like to turn it over to back over to Judge Flory, unless there's a question.
We'll question Representative Scott.
Thanks. Real quickly, thank you, Judge Cahill, and Madam Chair, by the way. I see that you have a certain percentage for e-complaints, and you mentioned criminal. Is there a movement towards civil, too? Now, we're landlords, and I haven't filed an unlawful detainer for quite some time, thankfully, but those filings are another thing you have to go to the courthouse, and to me, you could have easily done that online. Is that something that they're doing now or are on the way to doing?
Judge Cahill.
Madam Chair, Representative Scott, that actually was the first place we rolled out e-filing. Was the e-complaint is separate because of that party matching, but our first e-file project was in civil. So now you can file, if you register with the system, you can file everything electronically.
Okay, I don't want to, so.
Okay. Oh, we want you to, though. No. It's just like ordering a book on Amazon.
Yeah, it's a little more expensive than that, though.
Chair, Representative Scott. All right. Before we go, we have a question from Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just wondering, this electronic stuff, it looks like you guys are heading in a real good direction here. I'm curious about, are there any materials put together to communicate the staff savings that have been accommodated throughout each of your districts in the state thus far from what's been done? And what is projected to be saved? Obviously, we won't need a court interpreter down the road, or a, what do you call them when they... Thank you, court reporter, and probably some interpreter positions have been saved. There's others, I'm sure, like that. Do you have communication materials that you have that can outline what you're projected to save in terms of staff positions that we can communicate to our respective counties?
Judge Cahill.
Madam Chair, Representative Drazkowski, we don't have firm numbers yet because since we're in the pilot phase and we're kind of living in both worlds. For example, even in the mandatory civil world in Hennepin County, still only 60% of the filings are e-filed. And so we still have a lot of paper coming in. We have seen a decrease in some needs, some of which we repurpose, I'll admit. For example, we took some of our old record center positions because we are now imaging a lot. We don't need people taking pieces of paper and putting them in the folder. To hire an internal auditor, because we thought that was more important that we have an internal auditor to keep us honest, but also that we're sharing with the state as a resource. Nationwide, when we've talked to other jurisdictions that have done this, they see a 30% drop in their need for the data entry people. That's the hardest number I have. Since we're in our pilot phase, we don't have hard numbers yet. But we hope to, if I could get rid of 30% of our data entry needs, I'd be very happy.
All right, we're going to let them finish because we have 5 minutes left of committee, and then I have a couple announcements. So, Judge Flory, if you just want to wrap up.
Thank you, Chairman. And we will finish on time. Even with these innovations that we've talked about here today, I do want to highlight some of the significant challenges that the court system is still facing. Our judge shortages means insufficient time for cases. The belief that a person has had their day in court and have been heard by a judge is fundamental to one's belief in the fairness of the process and their willingness to accept the outcome, even if it doesn't go their way, which is often the case. Today, our trial judges have just minutes to hear, decide, and rule on significant issues. Some judges in some places, this is referred to as McJustice. As the economy is worsened and the world becomes more of a do-it-yourself type of world, Judge Cahill talked about the pro se litigants, and this has increased dramatically, and these folks require significantly more time to handle their cases and places even more demands and stress on this overloaded system. Likewise, the non-English-speaking court users continue to require increased court time and costs related to expensive interpreters and the translation of court forms. With the past budget shortfalls and base cuts, we have cut positions across the state. Everyone in our system is doing more, and on top of picking up workloads for positions we've lost, we're asking that same staff to make huge changes in the way that they do their work. And as you can imagine, this puts great stress on a system that is already significantly stressed. And that stress has begun to undermine our workforce morale. The same workforce that we need to keep stepping up to do more with less. Thankfully, thus far, our staff has shown even more dedication than ever and have made possible the initiatives and the changes associated with that. And we thank them for that. And with that, that concludes our presentation.
Thank you, Representative Portman. And then I have an announcement.
Just a very quick question. Mr. Sharba, on the fourth slide, you said that the Minnesota Judicial Branch had 2,500 employees, and you said that was a reduction of a certain number since before budget cuts. And I just wanted to get that number since a lot of questions went to that.
Mr. Sharba.
Madam Chair, Representative, since fiscal year 08, we've reduced about 250 positions, so about 10% of what we have right now.
All right. Members, we're going to be wrapping up the committee, but I want you all to know that Law School for Legislators will be held on January 25th, and that will be from 9 to 5. I encourage all of you to go. I'm sorry? You don't get a... No, you do not get a law degree if you go, but we will be dealing with, they'll be talking about all sorts of issues that we'll be hearing in this committee. So with that, this meeting is adjourned.